this country is at war with Germany. With Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. The Parachute Regiment was formed in 1940 and eventually raised 17 battalions. It would see service in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Normandy, Arnhem, and would cross the Rhine as part of the largest airborne assault ever undertaken. To discuss the formation of the regiment and its history through World War II, I'm joined by historian and broadcaster Mark Urban, who has written an authorised history of the regiment called Red Devils, the Trailblazers of the Parachute Regiment in World War II. But before we get started, it's a big thank you to all those who have supported the podcast by becoming patrons. A dollar or so from people like you, loyal listener, help me find the time to put the show together. You can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcast. I really do value your support, and when possible, I try to make available extra bits and bobs exclusive for patrons. A bit more World War II chat, as it were. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast. So, on to our main feature. Mark, thank you for joining me. Can we start by looking at the formation of the regiment? It's interesting, as we enter the war in 1939, that we, the British, have no parachute unit in the army. So who's the driving force behind the formation of the unit? What function were they expecting the unit to fulfil?
Well, I think if you look at the history, the early history of the Parachute Regiment, it metamorphoses through several stages in the space of the war years. The idea of what it was for, and therefore what you had to expect from its soldiers, was really changing and was really dynamic. So in its first incarnation, or first stage of this evolution, it's very much about the mood after Dunkirk and Britain being on the back foot. And of course, it's Winston Churchill himself who in June 1940 issues this order that we need a body of parachute troops, which I think in the original memo, he says 5,000. And of course, that was of a piece with the orders he'd given just a few weeks apart from that to set up the Special Operations Executive to set Europe ablaze, as it were. And in those very early days, if you look at the sort of latter part of 1940, 1941, when they were training these soldiers who had been in this commando battalion to become parachutists, it became the first parachute battalion. They crossed over a fair amount at Ringway with their jump training with French resistance or other resistance agents who were training for the SOE, who were also being taught to parachute in. And so at that early stage, it was really about, look, can we do something to keep the war going on the continent, to not be completely strategically on the back foot? And so the Parachute Regiment was conceived as a way of putting in raiding parties, very much in the way that actually happened early in 1942 with the Brunavale raid, when 120 or so members of the 2nd Parachute Battalion went into Normandy to get the parts for a radar station. And they were ashore for like 4 hours and came back, mission, you know, job done. It was a very successful mission. So that's really the beginning. That's how it starts, with the order from Churchill leading to the formation of this group of parachute units, which pretty quickly starts to grow. But at the point, even when they do Brunavale, they haven't really got the aircraft and the know-how to do sort of large scale. You know, the 12 Whiteley bombers that are used to take them to Brunavale, that's pretty much the limit of the RAF's commitment to the whole parachute venture at that point. So it's all a pretty small scale thing right up to that point of the war.
Where are they drawing men from? Because obviously conscription comes in and the army, you know, vastly expands very quickly. Are they press ganging men in? Are they conscripting men into the airborne? Are they looking for a certain type of man? I mean, the Americans are very keen on getting the best of the best into their, you know, mentally and physically into their airborne units and to be seen as sort of a super elite, supermen sort of units. So where are the British drawing the men from?
Well, you've got that initial cohort who are in the commandos, and then they're briefly called the 11th Special Air Service Battalion, and then they become the first parachute battalion of the Army Air Corps, as it is at the time. Then in the latter part of 1941, late summer, the call goes out volunteers. The decision's taken. The key figure, I think, in this is the Chief of the Imperial General Staff. You know, let's build this bigger. Let's build a brigade or whatever. Let's have several battalions. And the first battalion, it becomes the kind of seed corps, providing cadres for three more. So you get four battalions formed in Britain at that time, going through into the early part of 1942. So through that autumn of 41 and the winter, those four battalions are formed. And they're formed from around 2,000 volunteers who come from across the army, and a sort of absolutely extraordinary variety of people, whether they're, you know, from Scottish regiments, the Royal Ulster Rifles, you know, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I mean, every conceivable type of regiment, every conceivable type of person. But broadly, what you can say they tend to have in common is they tend to be older guys who are fed up with barrack room bull and spit and polish, and they want to get into action. And one of the early members of the 1st Parachute Battalion actually says that 70% of that initial cadre were men who'd seen action before. And that would have been on the northwest frontier of India. That might have been in the Spanish Civil War even. There were a lot of adventurer types in that early cohort. And generally, they were older. You know, obviously, the conscripts were coming in at 18, 19. But a lot of these guys, I focus my story on six particular soldiers. And when we meet a handful of them, they're all part of that 2,000 that volunteered, or several of them are part of it. You know, I point out that one of them is a Lance Corporal of 28. You know, another is a Sergeant of 30, Major Geoffrey Pine Coffin. He's already been in the army for 14 years. By that point, he's 32. So these are really older, more experienced guys than the typical conscripts that are coming in, or the junior officers coming through the OCTU system, you know, who might be 19 or 20. They're quite different in that sense. And they form, if you like, the vital first cadre, or the founding fathers, the trailblazers, as we call them in the title of the book, of the regiment. And they're the guys who, in late 1942, as the 1st Parachute Brigade, three of those four early battalions are sent to North Africa, where they have terrible, terrible struggles, you know, in their fights in the Tunisian mountains in the middle of winter. And a lot of them don't come back. I mean, of the 1,800 sent, there are 1,800 sent, and there are 1,700 casualties in that campaign. Now, obviously, those figures, you know, there are reinforcements at times, and some of those casualties are wounded who come back into the line. You know, it's a complex equation, but that figure gives an insight into just how costly the campaign was. But by the end of that campaign in May 1943, you can truly say that the reputation of the parachute regiment, particularly amongst its enemies, has been established.
Well, I was going to ask about that, because in many respects, that Tunisia Operation Torch campaign, when you think about the parachute regiment, you might go Operation Biting, you know, Sicily, D-Day, Arnhem, that's the war. And actually, there is this operation in North Africa. What are they doing? Because it is completely overlooked when you sort of think about parachute operations in the public sort of memory of the war. What have they been tasked with? Had they worked out whether they wanted to be raiding or whether they wanted to be a larger component at that point? Or are they still sort of trying to figure out what they're meant to be doing?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I mean, I think one could say that the idea of what they're for is evolving very quickly at that point. So when they're sent out, it's definitely with the idea of parachute assault. And each of the three battalions carries out one deliberate parachute assault. The 2nd Parachute Battalion, which is the one that is particularly closely followed in my book, they drop at this Oudna place, trying to take out a series of airfields not far from Tunis. And that turns into an absolute disaster. But the operations that the 1st and 3rd Parachute Battalions mounted is as part of the Operation Torch, that sequence of events were pretty successful. And the idea was there, in the case of the 3rd Battalion, the first to go, that they dropped at this port called Bone, which was very near the Algeria-Tunisia frontier. And if we remember, the overall context of Operation Torch was that while Rommel and the Italians were kind of looking one way towards Montgomery, that to make landings of a large-scale force behind them, as it were, to the west of their main supply bases and logistics hubs in Libya and Tunisia, and to land west of those behind them and force them to fight on two fronts. So it was vital to General Eisenhower, who was commanding the operation, the Allied Expeditionary Force for that Operation Torch, to really get up there into Tunis as quickly as he could. And so the hope was, well, if we land and take a port like Bonn that we can use, that the 3rd Battalion was dropped on, then we can race up the coast and land troops there, relieve them by sea. Similarly, the 1st Battalion dropped in a place called Medjez El Bab, which was like one of the key passes through the mountains on the border into Tunisia. So the idea was, if we seize this choke point, a bit like the operation the Israelis mounted in 1956, the Mitla Pass, if we seize this with parachute assault, we can make it much easier for our troops to get into Tunis and really mess up the Axis forces in North Africa. So that was the strategic logic. But in terms of how it then evolved for the parachute battalions, they each made their parachute assault. There were only enough planes for them to drop at battalion strength at that point. And they did it. And then what happened was, they very quickly, because other troops just didn't get up to the frontier that quickly, or they proved inadequate, and it was a long old frontier, you know, the Tunisian border, the Germans recovered from the initial shock. They consolidated their positions, and they were now facing in two directions, west and east. And they were resisting. They were trying to stop the Allies getting in. So they then got involved in this long battle along the frontier. And as you may recall, you know, there were setbacks. For example, when Rommel attacked the Americans at the Kasserine Pass, and there were other moments where, you know, the British did quite well. And often it was either the parachute brigade or the guards brigade that were used to spearhead infantry assaults on Jebels, you know, high points that were key to the sort of advance through this borderland. I think a lot of them, you know, having trained so hard for parachute operations and realizing day after day, week after week, that they were taking these awful casualties up on these mountaintops, where frankly, I'm not sure the strategic logic of what they were doing was so clear to a lot of the men. You know, the Germans and the Italians were just trying to delay the inevitable, really. These guys were really suffering. I mean, the casualties were very heavy, and they stood fast. You know, they remained the most reliable and picked troops. And one of the letters home I discovered, and I felt really lifted that part of the narrative, was from a young subaltern in the 2nd Parachute Battalion. And he says something like, I realize that we have done what is being called a historic thing here. And he also has this rather humorous rate of exchange, where he basically says something like, oh, you know, the way it works here is, you know, one American division is equivalent to one Guards battalion. One Guards battalion is equivalent to two paratroopers. Therefore, we get all the dirty jobs. Well, clearly there was a bit of sort of humor and then maybe a bit of hubris in that. But the basic point that they really established, particularly with a high commander reputation, I think is well made. And that's why, in a way, it's very odd that the North African campaign hasn't had more attention in histories of airborne warfare or of the parachute regiment. And that's something I was keen to put right in.
I think it's because they're not fighting on geographically the Monty side of the battle. So Monty steals the show. And it, I think it must have been under Anderson, who sort of is never gets a light put on him, because Monty grabs all the celebrity for himself, and so that sort of those actions sort of get overlooked, which is a shame, because as you say, they're terrible, terrible fighting, slogging away in those hills. You mentioned the guards a couple of times now, and something that had occurred to me when I was reading through, the British Army can be quite likes to certain regiments have certain status. Well, when you have a new regiment like the Parachute Regiment with no status, does that attract a certain type of volunteer? Because at the top you have Boy Browning, who I think's a guardsman, isn't he? And is he driving it to be some sort of elite guards regiment? Or do we find more grammar school sort of officer class in there rather than Eton and Harrow and the top British public schools as the officers.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that's a, you know, that's a really interesting subject because, as we know, the British Army is a very tribal organization. And so the question immediately is posed when someone forms a new regiment or corps. Yeah, how do they fit in exactly with this tribal ecosystem, you know? And of course, when all your guys are coming from other backgrounds initially, because there is no established parachute career path at that point, you know, 1941 or whatever, when they're getting the volunteers, people come in with all kinds of different answers. Now, clearly, Browning was rather critical to this because he was given command late in 1941 of the Airborne Division, as it was called there, i.e. his mission was to expand the forces they'd already got, which was four battalions in Britain, also one in India and one in Egypt, but that's a different story, into a division. And Browning was very, very much a creature of the Guards. And when he did his ethos cards, you know, they said, he basically said, you are the elite and you've got to be better than everybody else. And including, he used this word, turnout. Now, for Browning, turnout was a really all-embracing term. It wasn't just having bulled boots and sharp creases on your battle dress. You know, your fingernails, your hair, your ears. He got men on inspections, on parades, to take their boots off to see whether there were any holes in their socks. You know, I mean, it was a whole state of mind. And Browning also, I think, had that belief that, you know, perhaps many a Guards Sergeant Major might have espoused in other times and places, that if you've got everybody marching together and you know, executing their halt precisely and crisply on word of command and all the rest of it, and about face and all, you know, the drill commands, that you would blend together these guys, you know. Now, obviously, the ones who'd come from the light infantry division, you know, they march faster. The standard infantrymen had one, So I think what Browning thought was, yes, well, you know, we'll give them the old army medicine to get them all to cohere together better. And we'll set these very high standards because, you know, if we deal with appearance, we will bring about the right state of mind. And I think in this sense, he completely misread the soldiers that he got, who, you know, as I was saying, you know, they were older. A lot of them were frustrated with square bashing and just the boredom of peacetime soldiering, waiting for the Germans to invade if they had the, you know, gumption to do so, sort of thing. And there were a lot of scenes, you know, uncovering, you know, in the archives, accounts written by soldiers about that period, you know, late summer 1941 through 1942, before they go to North Africa. There's a lot of scenes of like rebellion almost. And you mentioned the officer class. I mean, when Johnny Frost, the famous Johnny Frost, who's one of my chosen characters, you know, kept center stage in this narrative, takes the 2nd Parachute Battalion to North Africa, two of his three company commanders are guys promoted from the ranks. He describes one of them as difficult to deal with because of his socialist tendencies. And if you look in more detail at that A company of the 2nd Parachute Battalion, it's quite remarkable, really. You've got the company commander who definitely, his mindset is very left-wing, it's socialist. You've got another guy who's a platoon commander of his, who ends up being a minister in Harold Wilson's Labour government. He is Labour through and through, you know. So we must think of them as people, and as you suggested, a grammar school boy. And so we must think of that early selection of soldiers as having every kind of opinion, every kind of background, every kind of religious background, some of them very irreligious, some of them communists. It was in that sense, in terms of 1941 Britain, very diverse. And therefore, to try and impose a kind of Guards culture of saluting and only speak where you're spoken to. I mean, one of the rules on Browning's ethos card was kind of, you know, no idle chatter. I mean, he basically was telling them all to shut up. It obviously went down very badly with those soldiers, with their sort of wild individualistic spirit. So, yeah, that was a big part of the ferment, I think, in those parachute battalions through 1942, when they were waiting to go to North Africa.
He's a fascinating character, is Browning. And their next operation after North Africa is Husky in Sicily. But then they're forced in to work with the Americans, aren't they, and Ridgway. Ridgway's from a very different background. How does that relationship work between the American and British Airborne. I might have got this wrong. I'm thinking of my fate here, but I have a funny feeling this would be the first combat drop for the Americans, whereas I suppose the British can say at least they've done it a couple of times with biting and into North Africa.
Well, the first cooperation is when a single airborne battalion, if I recall correctly, I think it was the 2nd Battalion of the 503rd Parachute Infantry, but please don't have a moan. The battalion number is correct in the book. They get sent to England in the summer of 1942 with 4 dozen Dakotas for them to train with. Now, this is a big turning point for the British paratroopers because suddenly, and based not far away from Salisbury Plain, where they all are at the moment, there are these Americans, and they've got these Gucci aircraft. And, of course, the Brits, immediately, they've been jumping 10 or 12 at a time out of Wellington or Whiteley bombers. They immediately think, Christ, we can get, you know, 2 dozen guys into one of these planes, or at least 20, and we don't have to drop through a hatch in the floor. This is proper. You know, as one of the paratroopers describes it, Brits, when he goes for a drop, it's like a Rolls Royce compared with what we've been dealing with. Another one says it's like sitting on the London Underground compared with being in a Whiteley bomber. So there is that cooperation at that stage, Angus. When they go out to North Africa, that American parachute battalion is part of the British 1st Parachute Brigade. And, of course, the Brits, in classic borrower's fashion, use their planes, their Dakotas. But they aren't under joint command, effectively. And the Americans do make a combat drop at a place called Tabessa, which was on the sort of, it was rather further inland than the three British drops. But they do have a combat drop on a Vichy French airfield deep in the hinterland there in Algeria. And they take it. I mean, there's not much opposition. They take that. So in theory, they have got going before Husky. But you're right that by the time we're talking about Husky, you're talking about entire regimental combat teams or we might call them brigades of the 82nd Airborne Division being dropped on successive nights of that invasion of Sicily. And so, you know, up then they're really in the big boys league once they're doing that. And by that point, of course, later in the summer of 1943, they've got enough aircraft in Sicily to do these big drops, you know, rather than the 40 to 45 that were used in the torch drops from a single battalion. You're talking about, you know, 110 to 130 Dakotas at a time moving in formation with either a brigade in the British sense or a regimental combat team of the 82nd Airborne Division, or, of course, equally large glider-borne landings. So the whole thing is kicked up a level with Operation Husky. But, of course, with very mixed results in the sense that the all-arms or inter-service coordination is so poor that you get these epic and terrible friendly fire episodes where the Americans, I think on the second night of the operation, they have a force of Dakotas going in with a regimental combat team that gets hit by the fleet. And I think it's something like 300 American paratroopers and airmen die. Like a dozen planes are shot down by the fleet. So it's friendly fire, on the most epic and tragic scale. And similarly, the British had big problems flying in on the eastern side of the island over the Royal Navy ships, where initially the landings by the 1st Air Landing Brigade, i.e. gliders, had a similar treatment. And a lot of the American pilots decided just to turn around facing all this flak over the warships. And the whole thing was an absolute debacle. And then the night of Operation Marston, which was the 1st Parachute Brigade operation, I think 5 nights into Husky, possibly 4, but it's well into the operation by then. And of course, by that point, the soldiers know what's happened with some of the previous waves. They know that they've been engaged by the fleet. And lo and behold, the same thing happens to them. They've got, I think it's something in the region of 130, 140 Dakotas taking them in. And like a third of those aircraft end up turning back and going back to Tunisia because the flak is too heavy. Several of them are shot down. And then of the remainder, a lot of the guys are scattered all over eastern Sicily, but about a third of the forces landed reasonably close to the bridge that they've been told to seize.
That's the operation where Colonel Pearson threatens to shoot the pilot, isn't it, if he turns round?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think that's pretty well attested. Well, of course, Alistair Pearson, I mean, if we talk about trailblazers, absolutely extraordinary man. I mean, he was 27 when he was given command of the first parachute battalion in Tunisia. His family were bakers by trade. He was not a professional soldier. He established a rapport. So the other two COs, British ones, in the 1st Parachute Brigade at that time, Geoffrey Pine Coffin with the 3rd Battalion and Johnny Frost with the 2nd, they were both professional army officers, and they were both a little bit older than Pearson, a few years older. And they kind of looked on with a mixture of sort of envy and a sense of competition. They were all in competition with one another to some extent. And Johnny Frost sort of said something like, oh, he had the uncanny ability to sort of be in the right place at the right time. But I think perhaps he wasn't sort of leveling with himself about the degree to which Pearson made his own luck. You know, he was a very dynamic and inspirational commander. I think he addressed soldiers, you know, in a sense, the very opposite to someone like Browning. He addressed soldiers in the language of the Glasgow streets, you know, where he was from. And, you know, if necessary, I mean, there are accounts of him, guys reluctant to pick themselves up and move to the attack, he'd kick them, you know, he'd tell them to get on or they'd be finished, you know. He was very direct in his methods. And there's a great account from an officer in the 3rd Battalion who was lent to them, where he basically says, Pearson sent them up to the top of this Jebel in Tunisia. His orders were, you know, that very, very basic, go up there, hold it, you know, it's going to be very, very hard. You might be wiped out sort of thing. But that's your job. Go and do it. You know, very, very straight, very direct, no euphemisms, a very sort of simple but effective style of command. Now, Pearson ended up being one of only 8 people among the millions who served through World War II to get the Distinguished Service Order 4 times. So he was a remarkable character.
So back in Britain, when you've got Richard Windy Gale looking on and training, you know, they'll be starting to train for D-Day and Overlord. And when they're reviewing, they're going over the post-mortem of the Husky and the Sicily operations. Are they thinking to themselves, well, this work, that doesn't work? Well, clearly we've only got a third drop on target and a third become prisoners and a third become casualties. What do we need to change? Is there a learning curve that we're starting to see, or is the learning curve just throw more men at it?
Oh, yes. I think there is a learning curve. I mean, I think in the wake of Sicily, the big emphasis was on the training of aircrew. So the feeling was in 1st Airborne Division, after the setbacks that they had in Sicily, that a lot of these young American airmen, I mean, they literally might have been 19 or 20 flying a Dakota. Some of them were old mobilized airline pilots, but a lot of them were kids. And that they really didn't know what they were doing. And although they had had preparatory exercises and jumps prior to the invasion of Sicily, that this training hadn't been thorough enough, you know, to do with being able to line up properly, to deliver soldiers at the right altitude, in the right place, at night. And so that was certainly the big, when you read the kind of after action, the lessons learned report from Sicily, it's about the need for more, better trained, more cooperation, which really in the end means a lot more exercises and dry runs with para drops and glider drops. Now, the Americans, they drew slightly different lessons from it. So when the time comes to go from Sicily to the mainland of Italy, the British at that point are sort of, they're not on strike exactly, but they're saying we are not doing any more airborne operations while these issues of interoperating with the aircraft are unsolved. They basically refused to do more airborne operations during that period for a few months in the latter part of 1943. The Americans basically being forward leaning, it's just no, crack on, let's fly a whole airborne division into Rome. Yeah, at one point they're about to set off when the Italian government's about to surrender to try and do a sort of astounding coup de main. In the end, that doesn't happen. But they did drop a regimental combat team into the bridgehead in the south of Italy when they landed to reinforce their troops there. So the Americans kept operating. The Brits took a pause The other thing which I think you can say, and this, you know, this is one of those really sort of delicate issues where you see circumlocution in all the official reports and euphemism. And a lot of questions, I think, after Sicily about dropping at night. And I think the understanding is there. Certainly it was with Johnny Frost and the 2nd Battalion, that if some of your men are what I would call shy paras, and they want to just sort of lie low until they see which way the battle is going, that's a lot easier at night. So there is a sort of germ of doubt and worry about this, I think, which starts. And when you look at the war diaries after that, those operations in Sicily, there's an enormous amount of attention given to debriefing all the soldiers about where exactly did you drop and what did you do? And you know, when did you finally, because some of them, you know, they were dropped 10, 15 miles away from the objective, the Primosoli Bridge. So, I mean, realistically, it wasn't fair to have expected them to have taken part in that battle. But others were dropped very close. And Johnny Frost started looking at this and saying, hang on a minute, I saw these guys earlier in the evening. So some of them fell into the bag, were taken prisoner. Some of them appeared later. And there was a sort of, hey, where have you been sort of idea about some of those soldiers. So there was that going on as well. And that big exercise about sort of debriefing everybody and finding out where everyone dropped and all the rest of it, that was, of course, and partly, and most importantly, about this question of air crews and whether or not they were up to the job of dropping people in the right place. You know, if they were running into the drop zone under fire, flak, or would they panic and drop people all over the place because they just wanted to get back to base as quickly as possible and safely as possible? You know, there was an element of that too. So all these uncomfortable issues were being dealt with after Sicily. You know, to what extent had the pilots turned tail because they were afraid? You know, not all of them had Alistair Pearson pointing a gun to their heads to run into the drop zone. And to what extent had some of the men on the ground taken advantage of the cover of darkness to just lie low and see how events turned out? And so then, of course, later in the war, I mean, obviously the D-Day was a night drop, but Operation Market, September 1940, and Varsity were daylight drops, where I think the feeling had been that in all respects, you know, getting guys in the right place, that question of dropping accurately, linking them up quickly with their equipment, and not allowing the shy para the chance to lie low, that daytime was better.
I wondered if D-Day actually shines a light on that specifically, because you have that amazing success at Pegasus Bridge, which is a small number of men doing the classic coup de main operation where they go in, very quickly seize the objective. They're almost landing on top of the objective. But then you get the slightly bigger operations where it all becomes, starts to fall to pieces as men just get cast to the four winds. Then you think, well, actually, it doesn't really work when you're trying to get a lot of men in on a night, unless you're being extremely laser specific on what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big postmortem with the operations on the night of D-Day as well, because as we know, that the 7th Battalion, who went there to reinforce the glider troops from the Ox and Bucks, who seized those two bridges. And then it was the 7th Battalion whose command they came under and who resisted the German counterattacks. I mean, when they went to the bridges, their commanding officer, Colonel Pine Coffin, he only had half of his battalion there. And actually, when you look in, there are maps done in the post-mortems about where they all dropped, like color-coded maps. A lot of them dropped in pretty much broadly the right area. So the question is, yeah, it was different, for example, with the 9th Battalion and the Merville Battery, where a lot of them had been dropped way off target, you know, in these flooded areas of farmland close to the River Dee. That was different. But with the 7th Battalion, a lot of them were broadly dropped in the right area. But, so, you know, a significant number didn't appear. Now, once again, the questions, you know, the next day, kind of, where were you? Very, very difficult, because a lot of these guys had absolutely tried to do the right thing and get to the right place at great risk to themselves. But some of them had said, well, let's just go in this barn and work out who's where in the morning. You know what I mean? And Pine Coffin himself confessed that for 40 minutes after landing, and he landed really close to where he was supposed to land, he had struggled to work out where he was. And it was only when an aircraft dropped a flare and the spire of the Ranville church was lit up that he suddenly realized exactly where he was. And he was pretty much where he should have been. But he talks about being in a panic because he knows he's got to get to the bridges as quickly as possible. But he's not sure which direction to head in. So all of those factors are there at night. You know, you can have the most highly trained and keen soldiers in the world, and they can be genuinely lost. Or you can have small parties of guys blundering about, you know, bumping into groups of Germans trying to get out of there, you know, short range contacts, chaos, confusion, members of other parachute battalions they suddenly run into. So all of those factors are there in a night drop to a greater extent than at daytime.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Mark Urban about the Parachute Regiment. We sort of touched upon Market Garden. So back in the UK during Overlord, the invasion of France, that there is the 1st Airborne Division who are rebuilding it from fighting in Africa. And they've got General Urquhart put in charge. Is Urquhart another guardsman? He's not from an airborne.
No, he's a Highland. I think he's from a Highland regiment, but I could be wrong.
I was slightly intrigued about when you get somebody like that you bring in to rebuild the regiment in sort of 44, does he come with his own ideas, not necessarily having already taken part in airborne operations?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's very much a creature of the kind of Montgomery school. You know, that's the system. He had command of an independent infantry brigade in Italy. And he pleased Monty, who was therefore keen for him to take over the airborne division. He didn't have any background in the airborne division, and that caused him to be looked upon, I think, with some suspicion when he arrived. And that was very much mutual. You know, Urquhart's view was that these guys thought they knew it all, was the sort of phrase he used. And he actually found them wanting in various respects. Now, you have to understand that there was a sort of depth of anger within. Particularly the 1st Parachute Brigade and the 1st Air Landing Brigades, after what they'd been through in Tunisia and Sicily, a feeling that, you know, a lot of lives had been lost because of either incompetence or missteps by the senior commanders, a feeling that, you know, like with a lot of soldiers who've been in action a few times, well, you know, I was lucky, I got through that. Will I be lucky next time? So a sense of some trepidation about the possibility of further combat. Then, of course, you get reinforcements sent in to make up the strength once they got back from the Mediterranean. And there are sometimes some slightly odd culture clashes. Well, there were a load of guys, for example, drafted into the 1st Battalion from I think it was the Welsh Fusiliers. And they were Welsh speakers, and, you know, they formed almost a separate cohort within the battalion. And of course, you get all the old sweats, sometimes in rather petty ways, sort of basically saying, oh, you know, you're not as good as us, and you've got no idea, you weren't in North Africa, or you weren't at the Prima Soli Bridge, or whatever, yeah, whatever their gripe was, or whatever their stance was about new arrivals. So you've got a tricky business, and you know, this was something that a lot of units had to do in the war. You know, absorb casualty replacements and reform things, but certainly led to some very tricky moments in England when the 1st Airborne Division had come back, and you know, we talked about Urquhart, but there was a CO appointed to command the 1st Battalion. Who very quickly, I mean, literally in a matter of a week or two, managed to get them completely on edge and mutinous because he tried to insist on standards of regular army discipline and behavior. So including, for example, things like church parade. which the guys in the 1st Parachute Brigade, when they'd been in North Africa, they'd completely abandoned church parades. They literally, a lot of them had refused to go. You know, they some of them were communists, some of them were free thinkers, you know, some of them just said, no, I'm not going to do it. It's not that, you know, that's not what we're about. So the CO of the 1st Battalion tried to reintroduce compulsory church parade in the 1st Battalion. And there were lots of other things going on too, which was more along the lines of the Browning spit and polish type stuff, which led in April of 1944 to what was described as a mutiny in the 1st Parachute Battalion, where they basically 200 men refused to draw their parachutes to go on an exercise that evening. Delegation of senior officers were sort of sent along to hear their grievances. They were all paraded. You know, it was like, who's going to speak first? Of course, none of the men wanted to appear to be the ringleader, but eventually they started calling out their grievances. And a week later, the CO was sacked. And he was moved to another battalion. So there were these difficulties when they got back. There were a lot of guys who were angry. You know, they felt they'd been misused. They felt a lot of men had died unnecessarily in the Mediterranean. And, you know, the whole question about how they would be used in what some called the bloodbath, the coming second front battle, was an open question. Now, a lot of these guys and a lot of the keener young officers, for example, who were posted to 1st Airborne Division after it got back, fully expected that they would be on the D-Day operation. And in the month or two before D-Day, they still thought that. They only realized at the last minute it wasn't going to be them. And then they were absolutely despondent when they realized it was Gales 6th Airborne Division that was going to have the honor of doing the inland drops for D-Day. I mean, in a way, even worse, they made a fantastic job of it. So it was an operation that was free of a lot of the kind of mismanagement and tragic consequences. Not to say they didn't lose a lot of soldiers, the 6th Airborne Division, on the night of D-Day and the first day or two after. They did lose a lot of men. But they were completely successful in fulfilling their objectives. And I think that also rankled. And one of the young, keen young subalterns who kept a journal in the 2nd Parachute Battalion in their base in Lincolnshire, he wrote something like, everyone's despondent, you know, at the news from France. We, you know, the how do we tell our families that we, the creme de la creme, have been kept on the sidelines of this? And then he says, there's nothing for it but to go out and get drunk. And so they all sort of went off to Grantham and places like that to drown their sorrows that they hadn't been picked for, you know, the opening of the second front.
I do wonder when you get sort of Urquhart coming in and Browning, what you're actually seeing is a new regiment struggling for almost a doctrine and an identity. So you get all these new people arriving with new ideas. And then that hits the old sweats who've been there for a long time going, no, well, that doesn't, we know that doesn't work. And they go, no, this is how we're going to do it. I was going to come to Market Garden. I was going to ask, rather than pick through the fighting, because that we could be here for hours, I was going to ask how much do you think Market Garden, the problem for the operation, is one of command and control, because you've got Urquhart going in. Browning decides he's got to go in. How much can we put the failure of Market Garden, rather than the troops who are landing during the day? In many respects, the troops can't be faulted.
You know, everybody has their ideas, don't they? There's a lot of counterfactuals about, well, if only they'd gone up there within 48 hours, and, you know, if only this lot had moved faster, the Americans had taken the Nijmegen Bridge faster. There are lots of ideas, and in themselves, none of them are bad. You know, they've all got some merit, I think, these ideas. But my overall view of it was the whole thing was the most reckless gamble based on a sort of unbelievable level of optimism bias. And I don't think one can say, oh, well, yeah, but that's hindsight, you know? No, I don't think you can say that. I think if you sort of, for example, the controversy about, you know, did Browning know about the elements of those two SS divisions that were sort of regrouping after Normandy on the heath west of Arnhem, and then took part, obviously, in the battles against the air-landed forces? Well, yes, okay, that's part of the picture. But as many others have commented, firstly, they didn't have many tanks anyway. It was mainly the recce and one or two of the infantry elements, some assault guns. But they had some armoured vehicles, but not that many. But then if you ask yourself the question, and this is where I think it's not a matter of hindsight, based on what happened in North Africa at Udna, when soldiers were landed a long way from their supporting troops who were going to come and link up with them, based on what happened in Sicily, in both cases, effective German responses had been brought together very, very quickly, hours, not 48 hours, hours, by ad hoc camp group, you know, combat groups, maybe formed on a company basis or a battalion basis by an enterprising officer. So Pearson and the 1st Parachute Battalion briefly take the Prima Sole Bridge. Yes, it's a coup in the sense that it allows the sappers to take the demolition charges off the bridge. But they then lose it to an ad hoc group put together by a German captain on his own initiative, who's landed at Catania Airfield as part of a German division. But he goes up with a load of signalers. I mean, it's not quite cooks and bottle washers, but he goes up and he retakes Prima Sole Bridge. And there's only 300 of them in his little group of German airborne troops. As I say, these responses to previous landings should have been clear red flags that any form of garrison or training unit that was within 12 or 24 hours march of Arnhem could easily be thrown into the battle. And when you start to use the compass to draw circles in terms of hours away, you find that, you know, lo and behold, the day after they drop, you get the tank company coming up from Bielefeld, which was a training company, but obviously their old Panzer III and Panzer IV tanks were very valuable against paratroopers with light weapons. And they're thrown into the battle, you know, I don't know, with 12, 15 hours after the first landing. So it's not a matter of, oh, if only we got there within 40 hours. They're in serious trouble from the get-go. I mean, after all, it's just a few hours after they've got into town that the link between the 2nd Battalion and the rest of the 1st Parachute Brigade is cut. And, you know, I quote Victor Dover, one of the 2nd Parachute Battalion officers who's walking back from the railway bridge just after it's been blown. And another one of the officers in the 1st Parachute Brigade turns to him, and this is, you know, 4 hours after they've dropped in, and says this has all the makings of a grand cock-up. So I think the understanding was there pretty early on from the soldiers of 1st Parachute Brigade that this was a sort of desperate miscalculation. And one of the, you know, primary accounts I found was Gerald Lathbury, the brigade commander, writing after the war, just a couple of years after the war, to Chester Wilmot, a journalist. And he said the plan could only have worked against minimal opposition. So their sort of base assumptions. I've given you a very long answer to this, Angus, because
it's a very big question.
Well, it's a big question. And as we know, so many books and you know, monographs and theories have been expanded. The other thing I would say about it, and this comes back to the success of the 6th Airborne Division in Normandy and when they do the Rhine crossing operation, Varsity. If you ask yourself the hard question about what was exceptional about the British Army in World War II, and you might say, yeah, well, the powers were pretty good, and then, yeah, this and that and the other, and all of that's true. But I would argue the thing that was exceptional, and I say this as a former tank guy, was the artillery. The artillery, if you look at the Battle of Normandy, when it's all going slick, you know, with their artillery support, and you've got your forward observers very smartly bringing in, you know, the concentration of fire as opposed to the concentration of force from these Army Group Royal Artillery units with this stunning weight of fire that they can bring down on German counterattacks and support their own attacks with. That's where the British Army has a really dramatically better capability than the Germans. And you see it in the Normandy battles, and you see it with Gale when he's looking at Market Garden. He says, well, the problem was the command arrangement, coming back to your original question, because they were under Browning of 1st Airborne Corps and had to be then switched to 30 Corps when they got close enough. His point is that command arrangement, and his key words is fixes responsibility. Now, he knew that because he was under the command of the Corps commander landing on the beaches just behind them, that this general commanding 1st Corps, I believe it was, had a really strong interest in making sure that 6th Airborne Division didn't get overwhelmed. because they were under his command. And coming back to my artillery point, you know, as soon as they've got an established bridgehead, even before you can argue with the naval gunfire support, but certainly as soon as they were ashore, with all of those different regiments, the medium regiments, the heavy regiments, Royal Artillery, they could bring just thumping fire to bear in support of 6th Airborne Division. And same thing happens with Varsity. You know, there's just this mass of artillery that just breaks up the German attempts to firstly to hold their ground and then to counterattack when they've lost it. Long detour back to Arnhem. But of course, it's clear that when you insert people 80 kilometers from the nearest friendly forces, and they've then got to drive against intense opposition to get up to them, that firstly, you know, on the Hell's Highway, the ground column, all the rest of it, that their artillery support is going to be used just helping them to get through and keeping the corridor open. We know the corridor was severed a couple of times. And even when they get very close, when it's near the end in the cauldron, and at last the artillery, the medium regiment from, I think it was the... was it the Welsh Division? I can't remember, but they fire in support of the paratroopers beleaguered in the cauldron, and you know that suddenly lifts the spirits of the besieged men. Even then, the amount of fire that they can bring to bear is pretty limited because of the range and all the other tasks that they need to assign that regiment to, Field Regiment Royal Artillery. And that's the key thing they haven't had, whereas the Germans, compressing the cauldron day after day, have got their mortars and artillery, other forms of artillery, just thumping away. With a secure supply of ammunition. It's a massive factor, I think, in what happened at Market Garden.
That's a fascinating point. Not considered, but so is that the, you know, because Varsity is a success, a huge success for the airborne. Is that the crucial extra factor? Because they don't actually drop that far. They have artillery support when they drop for Varsity, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I did the talk the other day at the National Army Museum, I came up with this phrase, that Operation Varsity was an airborne operation designed by health and safety. Because actually what they've tried to do with it, and it was an American Corps command, remember, they tried to eliminate all the jeopardy that hard-won experience had taught them. So, yes, obviously they do it by daytime rather than at night. They try and land the whole force as a single wave, not as successive waves as they had done, you know, in Normandy and Market Garden. And, of course, they make sure that the objectives along this river that runs almost parallel with the Rhine, the Weser, they basically set objectives of bridges and other places along that line, that they are effectively what you might say one tactical bound ahead of the Rhine crossing itself, so that the forces that get across have only got to motor for like an hour or two to relieve the paratroopers. Now, even with opposition, obviously, they get absolutely blitzed on the morning of Rhine crossing in order to try and reduce the opposition. And if you read the accounts, for example, from the 7th Parachute Battalion of Varsity, I mean, literally a few hours after they land, the first tanks are appearing and it's crack on. And they then walk 300 kilometers across the north of Germany till they get all the way to the Baltic by VE Day. But yeah, it's a very well-planned operation. But I think, as you hinted in your question, The objectives were set in quite a modest way as to what they should have to achieve. And then, you know, even then you can say, still very tricky. I mean, if you look at the number, a key role was given there to the air-landed troops to go in and land almost on these bridges across the Weser. But the number of gliders that were either shot out of the sky or heavily damaged, I mean, they're shocking figures. Hundreds of the gliders were hit by German flak as they came in. Obviously, broad daylight. So it still had its challenges as an operation and considerable losses. But yeah, it was designed in a way that would, you know, they hoped guarantee success.
So if we reflect back on the airborne forces over the war, did they deliver the goods? Were they worth the tremendous amount of effort that had been put into them?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, I think, you know, we started off with early days when people weren't quite sure what they were for. The numbers were very small. Britain was on the back foot. Strategically, it was a case of sort of trying to keep the war alive with resistance or raiding operations. Then I think everybody understood as the thing grew and Browning grew it, it wasn't really going to come into its own until the strategic initiative had passed to the Allies, and they were getting into the business of invading Italy and invading France. And at that point, they understood that in order to ease their people through congested bridgeheads, the ability to drop in depth or the ability to drop on the flanks of the bridgehead or to interdict, you know, take bridges that might be used by enemy forces trying to counterattack, all those things was really vital. And so it turned out to be, you know, both in Italy and on D-Day, it turned out to be absolutely vital for gaining a foothold, but first in Italy and then in France. So in that sense, I think the investment was very well justified. I know some people, and there used to be a bit of a feeling about this in the army back in the day, that people would say, oh, well, it, you know, it creams off a lot of the best soldiers, and then they're not in action, or they only seldom go into action. Well, I think, yes, it did cream off many of the best soldiers. I think that bit is true. But boy, oh boy, you know, I mean, those guys in the 1st Parachute Brigade, I mean, they were fighting in North Africa, in Italy. I mean, I do a little comparison in near the end of the book where we're considering this question of strategic utility with the 52nd Lowland Division, which, you know, it was involved in the fall of France. It was then brought back. And then for like a year or two, they trained them to be a mountain division. They thought, oh, we might need them in Norway, or we have to have a credible threat to Norway to keep the Germans tied up there and to keep lots of troops tied down. And obviously they didn't do that. Then they thought, well, maybe they need to be air-landed troops. You know, Browning with his ambitions for the core level of command. Well, we'll have two airborne divisions, but we'll also have an air-portable division that can be brought in. And that was part at one stage of the Market Garden plan, the idea that you could seize an airfield and fly in the 52nd Lowland Division. Anyway, they didn't go into action between the fall of France in 1940 and October 1944, when they were used in the Low Countries as part of the, you know, the battle to secure Antwerp. And then it had an incredibly tough war for the remainder of the war, you know. So you could say to yourself, well, hang on a minute, during that time, the parachute brigades were fighting in North Africa and Italy and all the rest of it, suffering terribly, but contributing to victory. So there were lots of other units. You know, I mean, if you look at all the air defense units, which in the end, in the latter part of the war, got raided for personnel because, you know, air defenses around Manchester or Southampton or whatever, come 1944, were rarely being challenged by the Luftwaffe, but they were soaking up hundreds of thousands of troops. So there's lots of other uses of people. I think someone's calculated that the airborne force that was in Europe and the Mediterranean theater was around 28,000 at the time. And even if you include the global airborne force, it was less than 2% of the strength of the army. And I think if you say, well, it was part of the reason why the Germans tied down dozens of divisions in an arc from Norway through the Netherlands, Belgium, France, because of the possibility of large-scale sea or air landing operations. And I think you can say, well, that is strategic utility. If with two airborne divisions and a few commando brigades, we've caused them to tie down, you know, 30 or 40 divisions, I think that's a good strategic investment. Plus, of course, the battlefield role that they played.
Indeed. Well, Mark, thank you for your time. I think, as I said before we started, I very much enjoyed your book. Low listener, if you want to read an authorised history of the Paras, Mark's book is Red Devils, Trailblazers of the Parachute Regiment in World War II. I will put a link in the show notes and on the website. Don't forget, if you want to support the show, you can become a patron of the podcast. You can find out more at patreon.com/ww2podcast. And for patrons, I will have a bit more from Mark, as I want to ask him in a moment about conscientious objectors who are with the Parachute Regiment. So in the next episode, we should be looking at the Waffen-SS, and I'll be joined once more by Anthony Tucker-Jones. Until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry, 88mm gun hit our town, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired. As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.